Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 197, I chat with home theater designer Keith Yates about the best place to put your subwoofers. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded March 6th, 2014, episode 197, How Low Can You Go? Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and Director of Content at AVSForum.com. This week's guest geek is Keith Yates, a well-known theater designer who is going to talk with us about, what else? Theater design and acoustics. Hey, Keith, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Scott. Glad to be here.
Sure, glad you're here as well. Keith and I have known each other for many years, worked together on lots of editorial projects, and this is the first time you've been on the show, and certainly not the last if I have anything to say about it.
Oh, thank you very much.
So those of you who are watching live at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Keith as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. So, Keith, we've been talking about what we might talk about here, and there are so many subjects in regards to home theater acoustics. And I wanted to start with this whole notion. I hear so many people talk about it, and I read it online all the time, that many people believe that there are certain dimensions that a room should ideally be. And the ratio between the length and the width and the height of the room become a point of great debate and discussion. You know, should the ratio be this or that, the golden mean or some other esoteric ratio? What are your thoughts on this subject?
I guess I'm guilty of having published a number of magazine articles for audio video interiors, I think, and maybe some others 15 years ago.
In fact, I worked on with you audio video interiors, and certainly at Home Theater Magazine as well.
That's right. And I was explaining to, I think it was Larry Ullman, who was the editor at the time, that these things that I'm writing about are really interesting and valuable to understand on the principles involved, but they don't actually relate directly to the home theater or home listening room experience for a number of reasons. First of all, these axial ratios, that is the length to the width to the height, are generally based on simulations that were done in the 1960s and 70s by Bolt and Sepmeyer and Loudon and others. And they're based on some pretty primitive assumptions about the playback environment. And most of these assumptions are not actually true, which essentially, if not quite invalidating the predictions, at least it casts a lot of doubt on the accuracy of them. And those assumptions are, number one, that this room is a primitive geometrical shape known as a parallelepiped, which means that it's a shoebox. Mm-hmm. It's a room that has, it's like a cube in which the height or any two dimensions can be stretched longer, shorter, wider, narrower. Real rooms, especially real theaters, are not these rigid shoebox shapes. First of all, they don't have one height. They have two or three or four because of the raised seating platforms and possibly a stage. Number two, the ceiling may have two or three different heights. There's maybe a height in the middle that's flat or pitched or whatever it is, and a height at the perimeter where there are large soffits that, for example, encase supply and return air ducts. These are typically for a theater. These ducts need to be large, 2 feet by 2 feet, rough, something like that, a foot and a half by 3 feet. These are not small structures. So the room already starts off with departures from this simple, primitive, extruded rectangle kind of shape. And from there, it gets worse, these assumptions. The next assumption is that the walls, the floor, the ceiling all have the same acoustic impedance. In other words, they reflect sound to the exact same extent that all the other surfaces do. So there's really only one acoustic impedance that describes the room's envelope. That's generally not true, especially in an engineered theater, where, for example, we may want to mass up a wall because the mass loss.
Meaning, make it more massive, more
that's
stiff.
Right. Stiffer, heavier, more reflective. It gives less. It doesn't go diaphragmatic, so to speak.
Right, and which means basically, if a surface like a wall is quote unquote going diaphragmatic, it's basically moving along with the sound, and in fact absorbing some of that sound, not reflecting it back into the room. Right.
Typical North American construction. The wall sheathing. What are called the alphas, or the coefficient of absorption throughout the bass range. Let's just say from 200 hertz on down to 20 hertz, typically range from 15 to as much as 25% of the energy is just lost in this diaphragmatic activity on the part of the sheathing. That's not a bad thing. That's typically a very good thing, because other than the walls being acoustically somewhat soft, what other opportunities does the home theater enthusiast have for absorbing bass and reducing this tendency of certain standing wave frequencies to ring in the room? If it's going to ring, it's because the low frequency energy is going to slosh down the length of the room or across the width of the room or vertically, and it can only slosh back and forth and persist for a period of time to create this drone effect. If when the sound energy strikes that encounters the wall, if all of it is returned back from whence it came, then you've got a big resonance. If some percentage of it is dissipated, that means, let's say it's 20%. So the returned energy is 90% of what it, or 80% of what it was. When it hits the wall where it started, let's say the screen wall, it loses another 20% of that. So
it's dying down pretty quickly.
64% comes back to the other, and then 64 times 0.8 the next time. And so after just a few trips, it's basically that energy's been turned into heat. It's been absorbed. It's no longer acoustically present in the room. So this soft walls are actually your friend in the residential or in critical listening spaces, recording studio, playback and control rooms and playback environments and so on. So these assumptions, to go back to sort of the history of trying to understand bass in the audio community, these were attempts to simplify the assumptions so that the vacuum tube computers of the day running on punch cards could actually deal with a problem. And we have this, it's sort of our inheritance in this industry. And so all the discussions start with this very simple assumption. It's sort of like the assumption, imagine a spherical cow. Okay.
I can sort of imagine that, yeah.
Right. So what we've done, Scott, is we've started with these assumptions of a spherical cowl or a room that has no features. It has no absorption in it. The walls are poured, polished, sealed concrete. It doesn't have big fluffy things called chairs in it. It doesn't have anything that goes diaphragmatic like regular construction does. So yet it's a valuable lesson to try to understand in the basic idea of a room resonance, but it doesn't go very far at all in describing the specifics of, okay, well, that's nice to know, but the customer, the home theater enthusiast, has a room or is going to be building a new room of roughly these dimensions. And so what does he or she need to know to maximize the potential quality of bass in that room? That's a different question that's only vaguely related to the work, as great as it was and as valuable as and insightful as that work was, the work of Loudon and Sepmeyer, and then after Boneo, after him, and probably the BBC more recently, maybe 20 years ago. That was, all of that work has been very good, especially I would say the BBC research by Walker. And the upshot of all this is that there really isn't such a thing as a great room ratio. It doesn't exist. It's a fiction. The old classic ones, like I used to design back in the, would have been in the early 80s. I just started designing listening rooms with rooms that, where if you take the ceiling equals one, let's just say it's 10 feet, floor to ceiling is 10 feet. Then the width would be 14 feet. The length would be 19 feet. That was 1.4 to 1.9. That was a favored ratio. It was one of the Loudon, I think it was one of the Loudon ratios. Another one was, 1.5 to 2.1. Another one was 1.6 to 2.33. So I did these rooms, like everybody else, and I wrote about them and for magazines and so on. But my practice, my actual client base, the people who were paying me money to design rooms, wanted something more than basically a bunch of arm waving about, oh, tell my builder what size it ought to be. I told him that's real important. Can you help him out? So about 15 years ago, Harman, the research department, Dr. Floyd Toole, Dr. Todd Welty, and Alain Devantier primarily, assisted by some other very nice, very good engineers there, real research guys, acoustical guys, they published the beginning of a series of papers in the Journal of the Audio Engineering Society. And I devoured those things trying to get to the bottom of the bottom end, you know.
How appropriate, indeed.
Yeah. And basically, I read those things, and I had taken some psychoacoustics classes at Stanford, and I went to Stanford and I met with a professor in the Dr. Samuel Haddad, who wrote a classic book on noise and vibration engineering, and I met with him about the problem of what does it take to really problem. And I said, it's not some simple arm waving stuff. That's clearly the case. Okay, we're never going to get there that way. And he said, well, the only way that's ever going to be solved is through CFD. And I said, wait a second, I've heard of that. That's computational fluid dynamics. He said, yeah. And I said, well, what should I know about it? And he said, well, I've taught a lot of students at the graduate school at Stanford this topic, and a fair number of them have gone into the CFD software engineer, you know, they create these packages. I said, well, it sounds like I ought to meet those guys and buy a package. He said, that's a really good idea. How much money do you have, Keith? I said, okay. How much is this going to take, Sam? He said the software starts around $40,000 and goes, what? The packages that would do it for you are between $40,000 and $80,000. And I just looked at him. I didn't say anything. And he said, and you have to pay $5,000 to $10,000 a year to keep your license active once you've paid that much. And he said, there are a couple of more caveats here. Number one, none of these packages will actually do what you want. What you're buying for, let's call it 60, 70, that's about where most of them land, $60,000, $70,000. What you're really buying is Microsoft Word. You're buying a piece of software. It doesn't write the novel for you.
Yeah, well, yeah, okay.
Okay.
In other words, you have to understand what the software is telling you in this case.
So that's what I said to him. So I got to really dig into it. And he said, Keith, listen to me. You pay the money. The software manufacturers will tell you that unless you have a doctorate in fluid dynamics, they all describe the software, their own software, as impenetrable and unusable. Lacking doctorate in the topic. But he said, I know all these guys. I'll connect you with these guys. They're my former students. So no problem. So this is maybe 8 years ago, 9 years ago now. And I said, okay, well, I've got a lot of saving to do to ever get there. But I do want to solve this problem. And I rob my savings, my retirement account, whatever I have to do, I'm going to solve this problem because it's too important to me. And he said, here's what you're going to find. Once you buy the program and you hire a guy, let's say you get the right guy, if he can't figure out how to write it, he's got to write basically an award-winning, you know, a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel or whatever it is, using the software, they'll give you your money back, the software manufacturers, all of them, provided you do one thing. Show them the PhD of the guy you hired. And the PhD either says the doctorate is in computational fluid dynamics or it doesn't. If it doesn't say CFD, you don't get any of your money back. This is not a toy. You get it all back when you show them the doctorate. And I said, I'm going to need your help on this, Sam. So that's where I started, Scott. And I get passionate about things, and I was very passionate about this and still am. And I ended up hiring someone from Europe. I went to nice American schools, Berkeley before Stanford, and so on. But I found that the people who could do this came from a particular European kind of academic tradition and program. And so I brought one of those people over to solve this problem full time.
And the problem being, how do you design a room with good bass?
With
response,
great,
good bass performance.
Not just great bass, because that's not hard if you just say, I only need great bass at one listening position.
Mm.
Okay. The problem is, when you get great bass at one position, you will be shocked at how much variation there is from seat to seat. If you take any of the standing wave frequencies, or these room modes, as they're called, eigenfrequencies, you'll find, and there are a couple dozen of them in a typical sized home theater room, you'll find that you just take your little Radio Shack sound level meter and play a sine wave, a test signal, at the frequency that is one of those modes. You'll hear the whole room take off and start resonating. It'll say, okay, it's 100 decibels here. So, all right, now go, you've got 8 seats or whatever, 12 seats in your theater. Now move it to the next seat and write down the number. Same frequency. And you do this and you record how loud it is at every frequency. I mean, at every standing wave frequency at each seat. And what you'll find is that in most rooms, including most dedicated, treated home theaters, the maximum variation from one seat to another seat is 30, more typically 35 decibels. It's often 40 decibels. And if you masked up the walls, like two or three layers of gypboard, because somebody misguided soul convinced you to do such a thing in your room, you'll find that it can hit 45 decibels. And if you're in Latin America or Europe or Asia, we have these projects all over the world, so I know about a little bit about this, because of the way they build walls out of concrete block, grout,
cinder blocks,
and poured concrete walls, that you can actually get very close to 50 decibel seat-to-seat variations.
Wow. So one seat is getting blown out by bass, and the other one is going, where's the bass? The sound is anemic.
It's at best. And what I like to say about this is that when you have a loudspeaker with reasonable radiation pattern so that it covers all of the seats in the theater, horizontally and vertically, and you then you play some octave band paint noise or so, and you move your little Radio Shack meter from seat to seat, you'll find that it only varies a couple of decibels in the treble and throughout the treble and mid-range. You get to the bass, and when you hit these standing wave frequencies, these eigenfrequencies, it's often 40 to 45 decibels, but almost it's rare to find a room that doesn't have them at least 30 decibels. And that's not hi-fi. That's not mid-fi. That's no-fi. So what are we thinking? And the poor consumers just told, just spend more money on a subwoofer, which the more you dig into what's causing this problem, you understand that even the most well-intentioned subwoofer shootouts and product evaluations are not reviews of subwoofers. This is sometimes unknown even by the reviewer. They are not reviews or comparisons of subwoofers. They are reviews or comparisons of subwoofer positions. It's how favorable was something called positional equalization. This is actually a technique in solving bass problems. Move the subwoofer a foot, right? That's called positional equalization.
I had never heard that term before, but it makes perfect sense.
It's bonehead physics. It's just simple acoustic. This is one of those things, Scott, where you're taking your introduction to acoustics, you know, at the local junior college or whatever. And if you don't get this, that you can only test a subwoofer outdoors, if you don't get this and why that's the case, the teacher, because at this point you don't even have a professor, it's just a teacher. The teacher puts his arm around you and says after the midterm, you know, Scott, it's not too late for you to drop this course and change major. I'm thinking for you, Scott, maybe something like French literature might suit you better, because all of the stuff that's important, Scott, is going whoo, right over the top of your head. This is basic science.
I hope that wouldn't be me, because I actually did study physics in college. Yeah. So, but I take your point. I absolutely take your point. We have a question in the chat room. I wanted to make sure I got to it before it disappeared off the end of the chat room here for me. M5 is asking about the term Q and whether or not that's appropriate for home spaces.
Well, the Q is a measurement of how sharp, how focused in frequency a particular resonance is. The more damping you add, let's say, like damping what could include some acoustic treatments that convert this acoustic pressure into heat or friction, which is sort of the definition of an absorber. You put those on the wall, thick things, or diaphragmatic absorbers, actually hang those on the wall. You change the Q. The Q is becomes lower Q, which means it's spread out more. In a sharp Q goes from this focused on a certain frequency range to something lower and broader.
Okay, so a high Q number is a very focused, very narrow band of frequencies that are getting that are resonating, and low Q number means that that band is much wider.
That's right, and you use damping to change the Q.
Right. I wanted to mention that I just wrote up a home theater on AVS Forum in which the front wall was designed specifically as a diaphragmatic absorber. It just mentioned, I just mentioned it now because that's what we're talking about. And it's one way, to tame the bass, as we often say in the room, which we want to do because we don't want these modes, these room modes or eigenfrequencies, to disrupt the bass performance from one seat to the next. I think the point you're ultimately getting at is ideally what you want to design for and towards is having as close to the same sound quality and amount of bass and so on in each of the seats in your theater.
That's right. The advantage of finding the lowest seat-to-seat variation, I suggest that for the next 10 or 20 years, the only way that anybody foresees of solving that problem is with fluid dynamics. That's how we address it. And now how JBL Synthesis does it, because we licensed them to a version of our process, which we call Basecamp, CAMP standing for Computational Acoustic Modeling Program.
Very clever.
And they call it, their acronym is much cleverer than mine. Theirs is FLOW, which stands for Fluid Dynamics Low Frequency Optimization, which I, you know.
That's cool too. I can dig it. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm sure in years to come, other people, Scott, will come along and they'll find some underemployed fluid dynamicist, you know, with a fresh doctorate and a bootleg copy of some fluid dynamics program. And he'll spend a year or two and he just hits on a few good, gets a few lucky breaks. And he or she comes up with routines that are basically similar to the way we do Basecamp and FLOW for JBL Synthesis. But it's very difficult. I mean, there's other techniques, finite difference, time domain, and so on that we evaluated early on and so on that may have some relevance. But I think CFD... it's the consensus that's the only tool that can really solve it in specific rooms that are actually 3D complex shapes with soffits and seating platforms and a baffle wall, you know, at the front that the left, center, and right speakers live in. These are complex shapes, different acoustic impedances throughout the room. That's on purpose in a well-designed theater. But there's just nothing else. I mean, an Excel spreadsheet or anything else has no ability to actually simulate low frequency energy and how it behaves in a three-dimensional space. That's what fluid dynamics is. Every car, every jet airplane, every motorcycle, even high-end bicycles are designed using fluid dynamics.
And yet that obviously sounds like the best approach, but it also sounds like anytime if you're going to hire somebody to do that, they will have spent all this money and probably hired a PhD fluid dynamicist if they aren't one already, which is then going to cost the consumer a lot of money.
It does, and that's really, frankly, the fluid dynamics part of this equation is only the first part of a much longer, it's the first step in a much longer journey, because the secret sauce and the thing that makes all this stuff work are the optimization routines you need. And as Dr. Haddad told me all those years ago, once you solve the CFD piece of this puzzle, now you need to get a guy who's got a doctorate in an area of math called optimization theory, because the CFD is just a donkey. It's just a beast of burden that gets you to a certain stage. I mean, it's just one step in this journey. But where all the fancy stuff and the finesse is in the optimization that deals with mountains of data. I mean, Scott, we just finished last week a simulation, a base camp for a cinematographer, major cinematographer, a large project in the United States. And we identified 64 possible locations for a subwoofer. All 64 would be completely invisible to the audience. They're behind fabric. You know, they're on the screen wall, hidden, buried in the baffle wall that contains the left, center, and right speakers as well. They're in the corners. There were 64 locations. And the optimization routines had to deal with 3.4 billion unique subwoofer combinations. A combination is a layout, like, okay, let's try how one subwoofer in position number 7 on the front wall, plus a subwoofer at position number 16 on the right wall, and a subwoofer number blah, 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 blah. So up to a maximum of 12 subwoofers total could be purchased and deployed, okay? So we stop it at 12. And there were the number of unique combinations of subs that it had to analyze the response at every seat and rank the seat-to-seat variation was 3.4 billion. It took we had to rewrite the MATLAB code for the optimization engine because our workstation, which is something like 96 gigs of RAM or something in multi-processor, and just, you know, it's a big $15,000 dedicated workstation. This is not a computer in my company that you send email from, okay?
Yeah, right, right.
It took that thing an entire week working 24 hours a day to finish this one run, this task.
Wow.
And it's at the point, it's if we would have chosen 70 possible locations, or you can have up to, customer will buy up to 15 subs or whatever for the space, it wouldn't have run. It's supercomputer time. So right. It's the optimization code, which is where that's the more remarkable, and I would say more unusual, and frankly, we got very lucky in some things. Some young PhDs in optimization theory, we read a lot of PhDs dissertations in this and other topics, found one not in the United States, and we got goosebumps reading this thing. I mean, holy mackerel. It's as if he came up with an optimization strategy that was that we paid him $100,000 to develop for us. Like, it's like a tailor-made suit that you just found on sale for $15. And it was tailor-made for you on Savile Row in London. I mean, it's just, what are the odds, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think people who've looked into this have seen what the odds are low. The odds of success are pretty low at trying this. And you need some lucky breaks. And as my dad once told me when I was about 18, leaving the house, he said, and I guess I thought, because I, you know, did well in high school and stuff, and I was heading out to college and so on. He said to me, son, of the two, it's better to be lucky than smart. and life has taught me that there's no substitute for luck. And we...
For luck.
In base camp, I mean, because you can hire talent, you can hire I smart. You know, however many ergs of mental horsepower you need, it's there are guys out there with, you know, who've got 30 IQ points on the rest of us, and you can hire them. And sometimes we do. So, but there's no substitute for being lucky. And in the case of Basecamp, it only really exists as a service, both Basecamp through my company and Flow through the JBL Synthesis at Harman family.
Right. Right.
Because of a combination of smart guys, a great advisor at Stanford, and on the optimization, just raw luck.
Well, still in all, I mean, even with raw luck notwithstanding, what can people who don't have lots of resources, monetary resources, do to improve anyway the base performance in their room? I mean, I've heard things like some people say, oh, always put it in the corner. And other people say, never put it in the corner. and more than one is generally better. I mean, do you have any sort of general rules of thumb in this regard?
Sure, absolutely. The first thing is get multiple subwoofers. This is not unique to me. I mean, this is something the Harman research team documented in all those papers with the equations and the test results and everything. It's in the public domain. I mean, Harman did the whole industry, in my opinion, a great favor by turning loose some of the smartest guys in the entire industry. They turned them loose on to analyze this problem and to come up with real world solutions to that problem. And those solutions are pretty simple. Don't buy one great subwoofer. Buy four subwoofers. And if you have to get four pretty good but not state-of-the-art subwoofers, or they're mediocre, do that rather than
buy one.
That's
going to be better than one big super-duper subwoofer.
There's no question. It's an argument that says that one great $10,000 subwoofer or whatever is the right way to improve bass quality in a room. That's an unsustainable argument. It's a house of cards. It cannot be sustained. It has no basis in physical, measurable fact or blind listening or any kind of metric you want to use. So number one, buy four. If they're not real big, powerful subs, then put one in each corner. If you say, well, I've got the real estate and I saved my money, I got the budget to buy four subs, but they're all pretty, you know, each one of these is a real man sub. Then you might want to try placing each sub at the midpoint of the four walls. That will give you lower overall output level, but it will be somewhat smoother from seat to seat. And remember, we care about smoothness of the response or the similarity of the response at every seat. We care about it. Why? Because once the response is highly similar at every seat, when you fix it at the money seat, you simultaneously fixed it at all seats because the response is.
Very good point. If their responses are all similar, you basically fix it when you're tweaking it with EQ, I assume you mean.
That's right.
And you've got the microphone in the money seat, which is the lord of the house's seat. it'll affect the other seats relatively equally.
That's right. So that's the holy grail, and I would say that's part. It's not the holy grail. It's a piece of a bigger puzzle. It's the first and most important piece. Is can we get the bass to stop ringing like a dinner bell at every
dinner bell.
Yeah, a giant, you know, dinner bell at one seat and at 3 feet away or 5 feet away at another seat. You don't even know what's playing. You don't even know it's rattling the teeth out of everyone's heads in seats 3, 4, and 7. And at 1, 2, and 3 seats, they don't even know that. other than the shrieks of pain from the people sitting in the back, right. They don't even know that note's being played in the room. I mean, these are severe, sort of corrosive kinds of response anomalies that have no place in any, sound lover's playback room.
Right.
And yet this problem is a basic physics problem, needs to be solved. And getting the seat-to-seat variation down so we can fix the response at every seat is what Basecamp is all about, and flow. And who knows what'll come along later. 10 years from now, this field, or 15 years from now, this will be filled with lots of options. Right now, there's, as far as we know, there's just us. So, but it's too important of a problem for the rest of the industry to ignore for much longer. Right. So,
Yeah, yeah. SoundPro69 in the chat room is asking if you've ever heard of the, quote, master set speaker placement technique by which the speakers are placed in the room so that they create one coordinated piston action in the bass. Do you have an opinion about this, what he calls a secretive setup process?
Well, if you're just talking about timeline, I've never heard of this, but if you're talking about just time aligning the wavefronts from the different subwoofers so that they're all impinging on the money seat, let's say a microphone at the head position at the same time, that doesn't require any secretive processes or anything. That's a simple measurement. Any acoustic test instrument and a cheap microphone would be able to tell you that. So I don't know. Maybe there's more to what this person who's asking the question. Is there any additional information?
Could be. Well, SoundPro 69, when you get a chance, if you can add a little bit more to that in the chat room, maybe I can pass that along. Now, we were talking about EQ, and I think this is a very important subject. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think your whole philosophy here is you want to get the subwoofer, you want to get the room environment and the subwoofer placement correct for minimal seat-to-seat variation, after which you can apply some EQ and fine-tune things. Now, a couple of questions come to mind. One is, it's okay to EQ if you're bringing down, a particularly strong frequency. But if you're sitting in what's called a null, that is a place where a particular frequency is getting canceled, you can't crank that frequency in an EQ and get it back. It's never going to be there. It's always gone, right?
That's right. It's but this is just basic equalization stuff. I mean, that's correct. And whoever told you that, many people, I'm sure, but that's correct. But that's like equalization 101. I mean, this has been known since I started in hi-fi in 1972, working full-time for a, quote, high-end dealer, Macintosh, Marantz, JBL, et cetera, dealer at that time. And we used the Altec Lansing Acousta voice equalizers, I think, at that time, even in these home systems. And we all knew that you don't go trying to fix a hole. I mean, you can sometimes we'll take a look to see if it is a fixable thing, and that this simple rule of thumb, take a look at how low in magnitude, let's say the dip bottoms out at 75 decibels on the test tone that you're playing. So you got 75 decibels. So, okay, let's punch in into our DSP or slide the band on the equalizer up exactly 6 decibels. Okay. Mm-hmm. 6 decibels. So if it was, let's say 75, and we add 6 and we get 81 out of it, then this is probably not a cancellation problem, an unfixable problem.
Right.
However, what you'll typically find is that this is a cancellation, it's a reflected some reflected energy is adding, is creating destructive interference with the signal, and it you put in 6 decibels and all you get out of it is 2 or 1 or 3, in which case all you're doing is by quote fixing this problem and filling in this little trough is to drive the amplifier and the speaker or the subwoofer crazy with additional excursion demands and that go nowhere. The only thing they produce is more harmonic distortion and power compression on the part of the subwoofer. So that's like going to the bank and opening up a savings account. And the deal with the bank is for every $100 you put in, they'll keep 60 and deposit in your account 40. Hmm. I mean, this is an untenable situation.
So. Indeed. Yeah. Well, what about the other question I had regards these automatic room correction routines that you find in AV receivers and preamp processors and so on from companies like Odyssey and Trinov and proprietary ones from Pioneer and Yamaha. I've heard some people say they work wonders. I've heard other people say they're total junk. What's your opinion on these? And do any work better than others?
My experience is, I would say, incomplete. It's inadequate for me to give you a real and informed kind of report or finding on that. Mm. However, mm. We've done Trinovs. We were the first in the United States to be using Trinovs in home theaters. We've done some of the big ones. They've been part of the signal processing chain in our theaters for, there's a handful of them, half a dozen projects or something at this point, with the Trinov MC, I think it's called. And the fellow, Kurt Hoyt, who is Trinov in the United States, is a friend and even collaborator on in certain signal processing areas with us on certain projects. And that's a very powerful tool. We've done projects with Steinway Lingdorf on their large system with their automatic correction system.
Right. Also, I think they have a proprietary one as well, as I recall. Yeah,
they do. And that was the first one I heard that I really thought was good. The ones I've thought, you know, this is pretty darn respectable. I would say there's two projects I did that have a JBL Synthesis S-DEC 4500. We just let it run just to see how it would work, and then measured using our normal measurement system to 8 Earthworks M30 mics at different locations, and we use this German software as for that particular task. And we listened to it, and I thought it sounds good, and it measures well, and we didn't have to do anything except just let it crank away. So I liked that one.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard pretty good results out of just letting a Trinov do its thing. The secret with a Trinov, though, is there are lots of settings, minor, you know, small things where you can drill down into submenus and get to I mean, with a Trinov, you might want to say, I only want to fix the direct sound right now. So just give me the first 3 cycles of any particular frequency and then basically cut it out. I don't want to see the effect of later reflections or even reverberation in the room on the response. I just want to look at the direct sound, and that's what I want to fix. Let's say that's what you want to do. You can do that on a Trinov, and that's a valuable tool. So a Trinov is essentially a computer. It's running, well, it's a Linux computer that's running a bunch of audio routines and sophisticated routines. And a Trinov can fix things that no other processor can fix. Maybe you need those things fixed in your room, and maybe you don't have those problems. So the Trinov is just another tool that may be relevant to your, you know, maybe a good candidate for you and maybe not. So there's, you know, lots of things that go sort of guide what path do we go down. I can tell you that in my projects, the most, what I would say is both stunning in terms of the measured response and also sort of the feel, just subjectively, the lights go out, movie comes up, you end up with big goosebumps pretty quick. I mean, those, you know, that kind of thing that goes way beyond, is this the, you know, Fourier-Bessel transformer, the whatever that's doing this, which is how a Trinov works. Is, you know, they've
Of course, you're not thinking about those technical issues when the lights go down, the movie comes up, and you get goosebumps. You want that emotional response, but that I believe is predicated at least in part on having done the homework and the technical details about getting the sound right in the room.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Scott. And the most stunning results in, I'm just speaking, this is not a judgment on anybody's DSP boxes, okay? Because we've used BSSs and SIMnets and Ashley Proteas and Behringers and Trinovs and Lakes. And I mean, starting 20-some years, BSSs, 20-some years ago, we don't do projects that don't have DSPs. And this is year 23 or 24 of Keith Yates Design Group, which was just a continuation of the previous company of mine that did basically the same thing.
Right.
So it goes back now 40 years, basically. But we don't, in the last 23 or 24 years, we won't even accept a project that doesn't have a DSP box for us to calibrate. You don't want it calibrated. You want to buy a Ferrari, but you don't want to tune up before you drive off in it. You're not getting it from us. Right. You know, good luck to you.
Right.
So they're all just boxes, really. And it all comes down, it's just a tool. It's sort of like, it's really like, your system needs surgery. It's like you need, okay, so you need surgery. And you can use a guy, a surgeon, who says, hire me because I use these scalpels made in Switzerland by gnomes in this particular forest, okay?
Yeah.
And the scalpel costs $30,000 a piece. Or there's another guy who says, who's a famous surgeon and considered a rock star among surgeons by other surgeons. And he's not just another local guy whose brother-in-law is the importer of some exorbitantly overpriced scalpels from gnomes in Switzerland. Okay. And so the guy says, and that guy says, you don't need a $30,000 scalpel to fix this problem. What you need is somebody who knows what to cut and what to leave and how to do their job. So which guy are you going to hire? You're going to hire a surgeon who knows what the hell he's doing.
Yeah.
And not a surgeon who says, hire me because I'm using this
particular
scalpel
tool
made of out of unobtainium, you know?
Right.
So, and in our industry, people get hung up on, you know, this DSP or that DSP, this speaker or that speaker wire, or, and it's frequently sort of beside the point. You know, it's not that it isn't at some level interesting, but they're so deep into the minutiae and they haven't, it's a conversation about what kind of wax do we use to polish the hubcaps of this car. And you think, yeah, but this is a 19, 30s classic car I got. And I have $100,000 to put it into Concours condition. And I just spent $90,000 on the damn hubcaps. And I don't have an engine or a transmission or an interior. I mean, what are you thinking?
So
we try to, you know, we have a lot of projects that have very healthy budgets. You know, the clients come to us with such budgets, not all, but some portion of our client base is like that. And if we have such budget and we can, I can use any DSP I want, including any of the ones I just mentioned, I'm going to spec a lake in almost every case. I've specified lakes. It was the first residential projects in the world that using lakes way before Dolby ever knew about the company and then bought them and then sold the company. And it just, it's better because the math works. The raised cosine equalization, if you look at how it synthesizes filters, or just write down in the mathematics of how does it do that, and what are the repercussions of putting two filters next to each other, you know, a boost next to a cut or whatever. Let's just say that you need to do that to fix a particular problem in a room. I'm not saying you would always would have this thing, but the lake will do that in a way that's predictable. Nothing else is predictable. You don't know what you're going to get. You have no idea what you're going to get on anybody else's. And it's not because they aren't using the right capacitors or the right power supplies. It's none of that. It's that the math doesn't work. The math in a lake works. I don't know of any other DSP that where it's fundamentally sound. I can fix things on a lake that you would never, I would never even try on any other process. So if it's my money, that's if it's my money and it's my system, that's what I'm going to put in. But there are applications where a lake cannot fix what a Trinov can fix. So a lot of compelling choices, but that's my take.
You're mentioning the company called Lake. Reminds me, and you also mentioned that Dolby bought them, later sold them. But when they bought them, the most important or the most visible result of that was a Dolby headphone, which is simulating three-dimensional sound field or a 5.1 or 7.1 sound field, surround sound field in headphones, which worked very well, continues to work very well. Yeah. And there was a question in the chat room earlier about, well, if you have real problems in your room, what do you think about using headphones with surround simulation like that?
We use headphones for simulations for auralization.
Which means?
Auralization is where, as a normal part of our acoustical design process, there's a very important phase of it called acoustic modeling and auralization. And modeling means you make a 3D AutoCAD model of the room. You then process it in a certain way to heal it of certain problems that you would, an architectural drafter wouldn't know he's creating these problems. They aren't a problem in his world, but they are as soon as you bring that model into an acoustical package. So you go fix those problems. It's not that hard, just a bullet list of what you need to do. So you do that. And then now you have a 3D room, this model. It's got chairs in it. It's got all the soffits, all the 3D stuff, just like a base camp model that we're going to run fluid dynamics on. But instead of running fluid dynamics to see how low frequencies slosh around in that room and build up in certain places at certain frequencies and so on, we're just watching how at higher frequencies, which would be, say, from about 200 hertz and above, roughly, you don't use fluid dynamics or finite element modeling. You use what's called geometric acoustics, which is based on ray tracing. So you put the speakers in the model. The speakers have, you attach radiation pattern descriptions of the speaker, so that speaker, when it blasts out sound, whatever test signal you tell it to blast out into the room, it knows how much of it at 15 kilohertz is the speaker beaming vertically, so that there's very little it's only going straight out, and very little of it's going up and down and left and right. Or what does the pattern look like? It's like a flashlight with one of the little ring, you know, on the face of it, where you can focus the beam.
Right.
Speakers have typically, multi-way speakers have, at some frequencies they beam, and others they're almost like floodlights instead of like spotlights. So you in order to do acoustic modeling, you have to start off with those speaker radiation pattern or RadPat files. If you don't have them, it's like, you know, you can have whatever car you want, but if you don't put gas in the tank, it's not going to run. It's real simple. Acoustical modeling program is like that. You have to have radiation pattern measurements, and almost no manufacturers of consumer speakers, including especially high-end ones, make available RadPat measurements. Many of those designers over the last 20 years that I've requested them, sometimes urgently, I can't tell you how many famous in our industry designers said RadPat. What does that mean exactly? Well, what are you talking about? It means radiation pattern.
Mm.
Radiation pattern. Radiation. Oh, you're talking about how it sends sound out in different directions, right? Oh, well, we've never measured it that way. You think we should? And I'm not going to rat out, because that's basically verbatim a conversation I had with a very famous high-end speaker designer. I'm not going to rat out his company or anything like that. He's a wonderful person and all those things. It's just that those aren't the consumer industry's priorities. And I was asking for a project which had a very large private theater that was now 20 years ago. Entire room on big springs and the 6-inch slab of concrete stage and coil springs the size of automobile springs that speakers sat on. It was all tuned to a certain thing, and I had these PhD in vibration engineering consultant that was working for me, and we did all this analysis on this stuff and all this stuff, and the manufacturer is going to sell for the first time ever his flagship at huge dollars. I mean, even by today's standards, it's like insane amount of money, but it's a really insane 20 years ago, that amount. And I said, well, I can't do the acoustic modeling without this. He said, what do you mean by acoustic modeling? I said, well, 3D CAD model. And see, what do you do with that? I said, well, I can look at the speech intelligibility at every seat. I can look at the direct to reverberant energy ratio at every seat. I can look at the lateral energy fraction. He said, the what? I said, LEF and LEF2. I mean, the lateral energy fraction, for crying out loud. I mean, if I'm going to design the acoustic treatment thing, and this is an ambitious facility, you have to know this. You don't just go put in expensive stuff and throw some absorbers and a few diffusers on the wall and call it good for a project like this. That's an illegitimate, just the concept of it is illegitimate. So he said, so after you get graphs out of that. I said, well, yeah. This is like 1993 and 1994. And he said, well, then what do you do? And I said, well, I listen to it. He said, what are you talking about? You mean you design it, then they build it, then you... I said, no, before they build it, I listen to it on headphones. Or I can listen to it, you know, on a early surround kind of a system. I can take the binaural room impulse response and... In other words, the kind of the room response, a mathematical description of what's going on at a money seat, or any seed I choose, and I can convolve or process use that response to process some dry recording, like a CD, like a two-channel thing, and I run that into the computer, just the CD two-channel track. And what's coming out of the headphones is what it's going to sound like in that room, because the model has bounced all these sound rays around the room and collected and found, you know, collected them at the listening location, and the direction is encoded where it came from. Oh, from this part of the ceiling, it came down here, and came, so from this direction, this, you know, part of the sort of the energy time curve, the time history of reflections in the room, and all this stuff. So I'm explaining this to him. He said, I guess he thought I was on drugs. He said, "You're going to listen to a room that hasn't even been built yet, and it's going to have my speakers in it, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of my speakers." And I said, "Yeah, if you send me the RadPad data so I can design it and right. then listen to it." But right. it's not like I'm just going to roll the dice and say, "Oh, well, let's just try this and see how it comes out." You can't work for clients like, you know, this, who have these kinds of expectations, without doing the science, and you're going to have to buy tools. So I started, you know, of course I had that oralization tool, is the first one I know of in the world. It's the first time, I guess that's a self-promotion or something here, but this was the manufacturer of that software said at an AES convention to me, "You realize no one else in the world's ever bought our software for anything approaching a residential project." Mm. 10 years later, saw him again at an AES conference and said, "You're still the only." Well, we have all three of the world standard, the three international. There's a Swedish package, there's a German package, and there's a Danish package. And not only do we own all three, we use all three 5 days a week in my company. I have one acoustical engineer in London. We moved to London from my California office, who does that 50 hours a week. That's what he does.
Let's get to the end of the story here, because unfortunately we're at the end of our hour.
Oh, okay. Well,
believe it or not, time really flies by, and I really apologize for interrupting you, but
No, that's fine, Scott. I appreciate the opportunity, and I mean, this is really some wonky stuff here, and we've lost most of the audience, but
we're all home theater geeks on this bus, so wonky is good. But I want to thank you so much for being here. And obviously we didn't get to nearly half of the list of topics that you and I had sort of talked about ahead of time. So, I hope you'll come back and continue the wonk.
Great. I'd love to, Scott. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. All right. That's Keith Yates, world renowned theater designer. You can find him online at keithyates.com. You can find me online, of course, at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott, also at avsforum. And you can also find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/htg, and on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twithometheatergeeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Alan Sides, a recording engineer and speaker designer, who will be talking about what else? Recording and speaker design. We had a question in the chat room about multiple subs in a recording studio. I didn't have time to ask Keith that, but maybe I'll ask Alan, see what he has to say about it. In any event, should be a fascinating discussion, and I do hope you will join me. Until then, geek out.